Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm William Lester, professor of chemistry and chair of the Hitchcock Professorship Committee. We're pleased, along with the Graduate Council, to present Professor Jikashi Toyoshima, this year's speaker in the Charles M. and Martha Hitchcock Lecture Series. As a condition of this bequest, we're obligated and happy to tell you how the endowment came to UC Berkeley. It's a story that exemplifies the many ways this campus is linked to the history of California and the Bay Area. Dr. Charles Hitchcock, a physician for the Army, came to San Francisco during the Gold Rush, where he opened a thriving private practice. In 1885, Charles established a professorship here at Berkeley as an expression of his long-held interest in education. His daughter, Lily Hitchcock Coit, still treasured in San Francisco for her colorful personality as well as her generosity, greatly expanded her father's original gift to establish a professorship at UC Berkeley, making it possible for us to present a series of lectures. The Hitchcock Fund has become one of the most cherished endowments of the University of California, recognizing the highest distinction of scholarly thought and achievement. Thank you, Lily and Charles. And now a few words about Professor Jikashi Toyoshima. Jikashi Toyoshima is a distinguished biophysicist and professor at the Institute of Molecular and Cellular Biosciences at the University of Tokyo in Japan. He started his scientific career as an electron microscopist and worked on muscle filaments and ion channels. Drawing on his expertise in the fields of mathematics, physics, and biology, Toyoshima has revealed the atomic structures of biological samples that could never be studied before. Using X-ray crystallography, he has determined the structure of the calcium ATPase, commonly referred to as the calcium pump, in different phases of the energy coupling cycle. Toyoshima's work on such biological structures has revolutionized how researchers are able to study the structure of proteins. Toyoshima is the author of numerous articles in scholarly journals. His research on the calcium ATPase, which began in 1989, produced the first images of an ion pump at work in atomic detail and explained why the structure has to be so. These images graced the cover of Nature, as well as served as an image for the journal's annual calendar. Jikashi Toyoshima was born in Akita, Japan, where at a young age his studies sparked an interest in the sciences. He was accepted to the University of Tokyo in 1973 in the physics department, and in 1978 chose to pursue biophysics, receiving his master's in 1980 and his doctorate in 1983. After completing his degree, Toyoshima served as a research associate at the University of Tokyo from 1984 to 1986, as a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University from 1986 to 1988, on the scientific staff at the Medical Research Council Laboratory of Molecular Biology at Cambridge from 1988 to 1989, and as a research scientist at the Frontier Research Project, RIKEN, in 1989. In 1994, he accepted a professorship at the University of Tokyo. In 2005, Toyoshima was elected as a foreign associate to the National Academy of Sciences. And in 2006, he was named a national lecturer at the Biophysical Society's 51st annual meeting, the Society's highest honor. Please join me in welcoming Professor Jikashi Toyoshima.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Hitchcock Committee and particularly Professor Lester for very kind introductions. But I'd like to tell you about just one protein, and this one you are looking here. And I'd like to tell you how this protein called calcium pump really works and why structure has to be so. But before going into details, perhaps I have to introduce for many non-specialists why this protein is important and why the calcium is important. Perhaps many of you here know that the cell is full of membrane compartments. And this is just a cartoon, but you see it in the micrograph. And it's really full of membrane compartments. And such biological membrane consists of lipid bilayers. And lipid bilayer, is, of course, consists of phospholipids. And the phospholipids has a polar head group and hydrophobic tails called acyl chains. And they form this kind of membrane sheet. And so the driving force is a hydrophobic interaction. And what is good about this is that it self-assembles in water and quite extensive one it can make. And also, it dislikes the hole is made, so it's self-sealing as well. So it's a kind of a super glue in a way. And it turns out to be just really the super glue. Perhaps I will show you in the later of my talk. And the property of this one is that it is very impermeant to ions. For example, sodium, potassium, chloride is here. It's much more impermeant to compared to water itself, pure water. So, and the result is you can make a concentration gradient for many ions, important for biological systems. And the common one is sodium, for example. Sodium, this is a case of muscle cells, and I show you how the muscle cell means that. But here, the sodium concentration outside of the cell is 110 millimole, and the sodium inside of the cell is 10 millimole. The potassium is the opposite. So you see the tenfold or so differences in concentration. But actually, the largest concentration gradient you see here is for calcium. It has more than 10,000-fold gradient here. It's not actually related to, this is divalent cations. You see the magnesium is here, and magnesium is just the same inside and outside of the cell. And what is important is this ion concentric gradients are used for many purposes in biological processes, and they are certainly not in equilibrium. And equilibrium means you are dead, right? Why the calcium is so important is explained here. And calcium is actually the ions most widely used in regulation of cellular processes. And if you hear the word calcium, perhaps you think of your bones or teeth. And it's certainly true, because most of the calcium in your body is in your bone and teeth. One human body contains about 1,400 grams of calcium, but only 10 grams or less, so it's less than 1%, is used for regulation of cellular processes. But so it looks like a very small amount, but it's a very important function. And in the human body has so many calcium binding proteins. And it's a good, I don't want to sort of tell you about the diversity of calcium signals. There are many excellent reviews here. So I just want to show you just one example. It's a muscle contraction. So you see here your muscle, and muscle is a hierarchical structure. So it's actually a bundle of muscle fibers. It's called muscle cells. And the muscle fiber itself consists of mainly a bundle of thick and thin filaments assembly called myofibril, surrounded by a vesicular system called sarcoplasmic reticulum here. So you see here, this bundle is called myofibril. It actually consists of thick and thin filaments. And it is surrounded by vesicular system, sarcoplasmic reticulum. And sarcoplasmic reticulum is a store of the calcium. And we also see, so this is a cross-section of this one. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum is this things. And you see this is actually a vesicular system. And also the muscle system has the tubule called transversal tubule, T-tubule here, right? And when your brain sort of make order for the muscle to contract, then your muscle, your motor neuron excites. The neuron excites, then the action potential is emitted, created, and goes down to your muscle fiber along this nerve fiber. What happens here is like this. And when your neuron excites, the first the sodium channel, the channel for the sodium ions sort of opens, and then the current potassium ions, potassium channels open, and then that make this kind of action potential. So the initial stage is electrical signal. So the electrical signals come down to this synaptic end. Then here, voltage-dependent calcium channels exist and make a fusion of these kind of vesicles. And these vesicles contain the chemical substance, so-called acetylcholine. And acetylcholine sort of is emitted here, like this. And so this is a chemical signal here. And the chemical signal, so the acetylcholine binds to its receptor on the other side of the synaptic junctions. And again, so the acetylcholine receptor is an ion channel. So it's pass through the ions. The sodium ions now come into this area and form the action potential again. So the electric signal come here, then the channel opens, and the receptor ion channel opens, and again it makes an electrical signal. So it's down to this part, so it's called T-tubule, and there is a voltage-dependent calcium channel, different one here, and it excites, and it's opened the so-called calcium release channel on the T-tubule. So the T-tubule is connected to sarcoplasmic reticulum. And so the calcium stored in the sarcoplasmic reticulum are released into muscle cells. If the calcium is released, it binds to called troponin C. The troponin C is a calcium binding protein. And it moves this the long filamentous protein called tropomyosin. And tropomyosin sort of prohibits the binding of myosin heads when the calciums are absent. But when its calcium comes to bind to this protein, then this tropomyosin moves and allows this myosin head to move productive interactions. Then the force is made and happens this kind of movement. So the key here is the calcium. And as I told you that here is the calcium channel, sodium ion channels, and calcium channel again, and another calcium channel. So there are many different kind of ions actually used for excitation. And one thing I would like to stress here is the channel follows concentric gradient. So it's a diffusion process, and no energy is actually required. But so it's very efficient. It's more than 10 million ions per second can go through per second. It's a very efficient system. We learned that calcium is a very important ion, but why is the calcium is so useful? And say, why not magnesium, for example? And the answer is that actually our systems, our living system, requires a lot of water, and water is really an unusual substance. And so let's think about what kind of properties are required for a good ion for regulation. So the good ion means here means that good ions easily pass through and can regulate the biological processes. So speed is certainly a problem. If you want to make the processing, the regulation fast enough, of course the ions have to pass through the ion channels quite quickly. And if the ions bind to many proteins, it does not help for regulation. So it has to have a very good specificity, right? But also, if you don't need many ions, that of course help, because you just a small amount of changes is good enough for regulating your biological processes. Then the next question, so I can sort of think of these three parameters. Then the next question asks, then which physical properties are determined these parameters? Size of the ion, or charges of ions, or something more exotic? Well, the answer is both charges and size. And so the inside the cell, of course, we have a lot, all the substances immersed in water. And water is, I mentioned that the unusual substance because it has a strong polarizability. Polarizability means, although as a whole, this is a neutral molecule, it has a charge. It has a partial charge, and the oxygen tends to be negative, and hydrogen tend to be a bit positive. So, when you look at the sodium chloride, so that's just a salt, when you dissolve it in the water, it's not just separated independent ions. It's actually surrounded by water molecules. And sodium ion has a positive charge, so the negative charge of oxygen sort of attracted and aligned water molecules to interact this way. And for the negative ions, charged ion, chloride ions, the water surrounds like this. So, and there are, we are living in 300K or something like that. So there are lots of thermal movement or thermal agitations. So this so-called hydration sphere or hydration shell is a quite dynamic one. Compare the size of the ions to water molecules here. The lithium is just a 0.6 angstrom ionic radius, and the biggest one I show here is the tellurium, and the 1.4 angstrom resolution. And in the water environment, it's surrounded like this. I just show you one sort of a hydration shell. It's called a primary hydration shell, but it's actually surrounded by secondary hydration shell and even more disordered layer of water molecules. So that means that ions are completely wrapped around by water molecules, right? So for the proteins to be able to distinguish which ion the protein actually needs, it has to sort of remove the water atoms, water molecules from ions. So it has to be partially removed, partially dehydrated, for the protein to be able to recognize it. So the actual process is sort of like this. So inside the water, there was this sodium ion surrounded by many water molecules, but it's a dynamical thing. So there's a chance for this sodium ion to lose the water molecule, and then the protein, oxygen atom, sort of substitutes this water oxygen atom to make this kind of interactions. And so then the protein actually touches these ions. And then if the ions pass through this very narrow part, then it will dehydrate again. That means the water binds again. So So for the efficient transfer, this sodium ion should not notice whether this ion is in the water molecule, in the water environment, or touching the proteins. So what that means is like this. So this is the actual structure of a potassium channel and solved by Makinons almost nearly 10 years ago or so. And so this is a view along the membrane plane. So this is the lateral view of the membrane. So this is called helix things. And the narrow part is here. So this shows the two potassium ions. So the potassium ions come from this way and get out like that. And if you look at in more detail, the potassium ions in this narrow area have an oxygen atom coordinating like this. So the protein atoms make a coordination very much the same as the potassium ions in water. So the potassium ions do not know whether it's in the water or in the narrow part of proteins. So the key thing is that protein oxygen atom can substitute the water molecule. So to discriminate sodium, the potassium from sodium, it uses the difference in hydration energy. So that means it's a chance for this ion to lose water molecules. Also, if you put sodium ion in this channel, it looks like this. So this is a view from the top. Because this has a four subunits, this narrow part actually has a four oxygen atoms. This shows just, so these four atoms. So in this real potassium channel, it has a perfect coordination geometry, just as in the potassium ion is in water. And the sodium ion cannot fit so well and because it is smaller. So the sodium ion is much smaller than potassium ions. The sodium ion cannot go through because because of a difference in hydration energy and difference in the coordination geometry. And I used the word hydration energy here, but I did not explain well. So this is the sort of definition of hydration energy. So the hydration energy is a change when one mole of molecule is transferred from gas phase to aqueous phases. Here is a sort of numbers. And so I compare the lithium, sodium, and potassium, and also magnesium, calcium here. So there are clear differences. Although the sodium is 30% or so smaller, the hydration energy is also 15 kilocalories or so different. And this number is actually a very large number. I will explain you later in my talk. And if you compare this number to divalent cations, the difference is so large, right? And so this energy means that if this number is larger, the chances for water molecule to detach from these ions become smaller. So this is a so-called water substitution rate. So this is the meta ion to look at here. And so the substitution rate means that water molecule in the bulk make exchange of this bound water molecules. So you see the sodium, potassium, lithium here, right? So following the numbers given in the previous table, the potassium has the highest substitution number rate, and sodium slower, and lithium even slower. And what is interesting is calcium and magnesium. Calcium is similar to sodium, right? So it has 10 to the 8th rate constant. But magnesium has a much slower rate constant. It has a 5×10⁵ or so. So it's clear that it cannot be used for microsecond regulations. So it requires much longer time for getting through the channel. But calcium is quite similar to monovalent ions. It's very fast. So the calcium can be used for transmitting signal by using channels. And so the magnesium is much slower, so it needs a special system. Not simple channel is not good enough for magnesium transfer. And certainly there are several magnesium transporters known, and they are transporters and use some energies and not really a simple channel using the thermal energies. Let's think about the specificities. Here, I compare the magnesium, calcium, and the coordination by oxygen atoms. So this picture is written in scale. So that this is you can consider this is actual size of the magnesium and oxygen, the size of the oxygens. So around magnesium, you can certainly place four this oxygen atoms and two on behind and on top of this magnesium. So the six coordinations is quite possible and has a very nice geometry, right? And for the calcium, it's certainly possible, but some distance is and still some spaces are available, and you can actually make seven. Just five oxygen atoms is completely fill the space around surrounding these calcium ions. So this, if you can put one oxygen atom behind and top of this calcium, so the seven coordination is quite possible. And perhaps it makes a very nice coordination. It will give a high affinity to a system. But if you look at the same configuration with the magnesium, it is impossible, really, because the magnesium is smaller ions. So if we put oxygen, five oxygen atoms like this, it's contacts too hardly. Too hard, and so it cannot accommodate this kind of geometry. And also, there must be a strong interaction, electrostatic interaction between the oxygen atoms, because it is becomes too close. So if the ion is smaller, then the distance between this metal ion and coordinated oxygen atom is shorter. That means that the electrostatic force will be stronger, right? That also means that this binding is tighter. But because of the smallness of this ions, it requires quite regular geometry of coordinating oxygen atoms. And here, if it becomes bigger, then the seven coordination is possible. So if the protein has seven oxygen atoms like this, it only selects the calcium and magnesium cannot bind. So it confers the protein specificities. So the big ion like calcium is just good, pretty good. And if in reality, this is an atomic model of one calcium binding protein called sartilysin, it has seven coordination. And this is the most common calcium binding motif, actually. And it always have a seven coordinating oxygen atoms. And this can exclude magnesium binding very well. So I can sort of list four reasons that make calcium ideal for regulation of cellular processes. It's a divalent cation. If it's a monovalent, the affinity could be too low, and you may need a big number of ions has to be transferred to regulate the processes. and it's large enough. Because it's large enough, it can give the protein specificity to exclude sodium and the magnesium. And it is a hard, so-called hard ion, hard metal ion, so it likes oxygen for coordinations. And some ions, like gold, likes sulfur atoms, and the protein is mostly consists of carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and the content of the sulfur atom is much smaller. So it makes sense to use abundant oxygen atoms for coordinations. And all these properties apply to, say, strontium. It's even bigger and has a divalent ions, and like oxygen for coordination, but you cannot find large amounts of strontium in the nature, so you can't really rely on it. So these four reasons make calcium so good for the regulation of processes. And instead, magnesium requires various regular geometry for binding and has a stronger power for fixing the oxygen atoms. So that means magnesium can be used for fixing protein structure and for a catalyzing reaction by putting electrons towards magnesium, because it has a much stronger power compared to calcium. One more thing I should like to mention, the very low concentration of calcium inside the cell. Originally, perhaps in the evolution, this was necessary because otherwise calcium, if it's higher, the calcium will precipitate phosphate, much that's abundant in the interior of the cells. But what is good about this is because it's so low, only a very small number transfer from outside to inside, then it's a big change. And that's also pretty good for the sensitivity of the system. And it's very efficient because it doesn't have to transfer so many ions. So many good things about calcium. And these differences in ion concentration used for signaling, as I mentioned, as I explained you in using the muscle system. In that purposes, the channel was used. It was a very efficient system, 10 million ions per second. But if the system has to go back to the original position, otherwise you can make just one contraction. It's no sense. So what is really important is to make these sort of stable conditions shown in this slide. And that is maintained by so-called ion pumps. And so the ion pumps works against concentration gradient, because after the excitation, the calcium sort of released from the sarcopenic reticulum to muscle cells, but it has to be pumped back into the sarcopenic reticulum. So this process occurs against concentration gradient, so it requires energy, and as I explained very shortly, it requires ATP. And so it uses the energy of ATP. It goes through cycles. The cycle is only 30 cycles are possible at normal body temperatures. And one cycle can transfer only 2 calcium ions. So altogether, only 60 calcium ions per second are actually transferred. So if you compare these two numbers, it's a huge difference, right? So if the nature wants to make the contraction and the relaxation in a similar time scale, you need very small number of channels, but you need a huge number of pumps, right? And I forgot to explain this to you. So it's the ion pumps, constant gradients are maintained by ion pumps. It's a real name. It's more sort of a rigorous name is a p-type ATP. The energy comes from these reactions. So the adenosine triphosphate, so the alpha beta gamma phosphate, the adenosine moiety is here. It's hydrolyzed, so this beta and gamma phosphate bond is cut here and makes a phosphate. But in the real system, it's actually this gamma phosphate is transferred to the protein first. This process is called phosphorylation. And what I would like to mention is that about 25% of ATP you consume is used for ion pumping, so maintaining the ion constant gradient. And the number of ATP, amount of ATP you consume, it's nearly your body weight. And it's a very large number. But so perhaps you have heard that the life's energy currency, ATP, and all living things certainly use ATP for energy conversion. And actually, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1997 have been given to people who study ATPase and ATP synthetase. But the energy liberated by ATP hydrolysis is rather small. And under normal cellular conditions, it's about 12 kilocalories per mole. If you remember the hydration energy of calcium, it's 360 kilocalories per mole. If you compare this, it's 30 times higher, right? So it seems that it looks like a very small number. And we know that this number corresponds to approximately 20 times higher than the thermal energy. So all the system is sort of shaking by thermal energy, and that thermal energy is about 6 kilocalories per mole. But if you compare these numbers, it's only 20 times. So the amount of energy liberated by ATP hydrolysis looks quite small. And so what we could do, and what the ATPase does, it seems not much, but it's actually the efficiency is so high, I will show you later. Yeah, so this is a point I want to make a few minutes ago. So you can actually count the calcium release channel here. So I mentioned that the number of channels required is very small, and actually you can count like in the micrographs. But you need huge number of pump molecules. And this is a scallop muscle. So a scallop has a very good thick muscle fiber. And in the scallop muscle, this micrograph shows that array of pump molecules, pump protein molecules. So this I showed you just one unit here. And all of these pump proteins, there are so many. And actually more than 60% or 70% of all the membrane, of the proteins residing in the membrane are actually occupied by this calcium pump proteins. So it's quite good for structure studies. And in structure study, we have to make crystals. And so this is a kind of very short explanation. And we have a kind of this basic system cut and ground from actually rabbit muscle. So it's the proteins at the beginning reside in the membrane. So the membrane is dissolved by adding detergent. So the detergent now sort of substitutes the phospholipids here like this. There are two ways, and using detergent only, you may be able to make a crystal like this one. It's completely different from the original alignment in the membrane. But what we do is adding phosphatidylcholine. Phosphatidylcholine is a sort of major phospholipid in the membrane, and make a kind of a reconstitution like this one. And at the beginning, or in the history of membrane protein crystallization, this is the one first made by Mihail, and he got the Nobel Prize. And he mentioned that this one is not very good because you cannot make large enough crystals. So nobody actually succeeded in making good crystals of calcium ATPase, calcium pump proteins, but we have managed to make crystals by sort of adding the phospholipid and kind of making kind of reconstitution. So this is a crystal of calcium ATPase, calcium pump proteins, and this is a cross section made by electron microscopy. And you see the scale is 1 micrometer. And if you look at the edge of the crystal, you see the bilayer sort of come stick out and make funny loops. And even funnier ones here, you see the end of the crystals, the lipid bilayer come close, just like that. And clearly shows that our crystals really have a membrane-like environment. So we consider that the crystal, the proteins in our crystal maintain the sort of native conditions, native structures. So the actual picture is of the pump protein like this. So this is so-called CPK or space fill model. So after the structure determination, we determine the coordinate of all the heavy atoms. Heavy atom means that they're heavier than the calcium and the carbon atoms. And so if you represent each atom with its atom radius, van der Waals radius perhaps, then you can make a sort of most accurate in terms of the space or volume like this one. But you don't see any sort of chemical bond here. You don't know how this the amino acids are interacting at all. So then one level of abstraction is using so-called ball and stick model. So now each atom is represented by still a ball, but the size is much smaller than the actual size. But we show the chemical bond, the covalent bond by sticks. So you see the spaces here. So if you consider that actual protein is full of spaces or vacuum, that's not true. And its real shape is like this, but to understand the protein structure, we use this kind of abstractions. And still, we don't see the structure so easily. The next abstraction is using the so-called secondary structure. It's a sort of kind of building block of proteins. And this spiral is called alpha helix. You can consider it a kind of cylinders. And here you see the kind of ribbons, arrows like this one. This one is called beta sheet. And so it's the protein structure. You can consider that the protein structure consists of sheets and cylinders and connecting loops. Right. So this is perhaps the easiest way to represent the actual protein structures. Let's think about how the pump or this calcium ATPase should look like. And we know that this is an ATP powered pump, and some dynamic calculation I didn't show, but the energy usage is almost about 100% efficient. And it must have a specificity to calcium because it's a calcium pump. And it should not pump sodium, for example, or potassium. And so it must have a mechanism for rejecting sodium and other ions. And it needs two gates. I explain it soon. It must be cytoplasmic, and this is cytoplasmic, and this is called luminal gate, lumen, because this is a vesicular system, and inside of the vesicle is called lumen. So cytoplasmic and luminal gate must exist somewhere here, right? The chemical reaction actually should take place somewhere in the cytoplasm, because ATP cannot go through a transmembrane part because it's a highly charged molecule. So somewhere in the cytoplasmic region, the chemical reaction should take place. That chemical reaction has to be transferred or transmitted to a gating system somewhere in the membrane. So, and my point is the structure should explain these things. And I go back to this gate things. And if, because this pump should work against concentration gradient, if it has only one gate, then there is a chance when this gate opens, then if the other gate is open, then the some ions should be able to go through and following the concentration gradient. That should not happen, right? And to prevent that, we at least need another gate. So this must have a two-gate system. And conventionally, the pump action is explained by this type of E1, E2 theory of calcium transport. And E1, in the E1 form, the cytoplasm gate is open, and the calcium can get in to transmembrane calcium binding site. The calcium binding site must have a high affinity, and if when the ATP binds here, it must be allowed to split into phosphate and ADP, and this phosphate is transferred from the ATP to a protein itself. And during this process, this gate, cytoplasm gate, becomes closed. It forms a so-called occluded state. And the release of ADP triggers the change of the structure, and the other side of the gate will open. That's called luminal gate opens. Then the calcium will be released like this. And release of this phosphate, so in this case it's a hydrolysis of phosphate, actually aspartate phosphate, and the release and phosphate released, and the luminal gate closes, right? Then the isomerization of structure change actually perhaps triggered by protons. And so when the calcium released, there are lots of protons inside this luminal area, and the proton can get into this binding site and sort of neutralize the sort of charge imbalance created by a calcium. But we know that at neutral pH, these protons are released and make this calcium binding site high affinity. So this is a cycle. And classically, E1 is form which has high affinity and open to cytoplasm. And it is true to some extent, but there is a position which has a the state in which the both gates are closed. So we can't say really the E1 state is open to the cytoplasm. Perhaps the correct definition, the E1 has a E1 form is a high affinity form for calcium. And E2 form is the same. The classical definition of E2, if you look at the textbook, E2 form is maybe defined as a low affinity to calcium, but open to lumen. And it is true in this, but only in this state. The other E2 state is closed. So a new definition, perhaps the most accurate definition, is E2 form has a low affinity to calcium. So I hope you don't sort of get confused. Anyway, the key thing is here. In this cycle, the two gates are sort of regulated. And in the no state in this reaction cycle, both gates are open. So in this state, both gates are closed, and the other state, only one state, one gate are closed. And the actual pumping process is done by changing the affinity of binding site from high affinity to low affinity. Right. So I hope I can make a structured sort of explanation for this reaction scheme. And this is a kind of advertisement for tomorrow's talk. And by making crystals of many sort of intermediate states, we can make this kind of movies. So this movie actually made from seven crystal structures. And the intermediate states are generated by simple interpolation. So I don't say this is accurate movement, but it gives you a lot of insight into how the pumps really works. From these things, we can ask why the movement you saw here is so large, and I show you the purple things, the calciums, the purple calcium bind to a binding site and will get out. And the ADP comes out and so forth. The calcium get in here and get out soon. Yeah, like this. And the gate closes like this. But you see the movement is so large and complicated. And why are such large and complicated movements are necessary? And we know that it's related to chemical reaction with ATP hydrolysis. Then what does ATP do? And as I mentioned, before the hydrolysis of ATP occurs, the gamma phosphate is transferred to protein cell, so it's so-called phosphorylation. Then what does phosphorylation do? Why is the phosphorylation necessary? Well, when the final overall reaction is just the ATP hydrolysis. I think I should stop here today. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for a very interesting lecture. I had a question. I came in a bit late, so maybe you answered it already, but I'm not sure. In neuroscience, it's very helpful to use calcium images to look at what's happening in active nervous systems. And the time scale of the calcium images is much longer than the millisecond time scale of the action potentials. So I was wondering if you could say what determines the time scale in this case. Is it the entrance of calcium, or what mechanism?
Well, that depends on the interaction with the fluorescent dye, right? It's a chelator of calcium, and the affinity is actually much higher usually than to water molecule. And what I mentioned is the substitution rate of water molecules. And in the water molecules detach and attach in the well, I go back to here. It's between the nanosecond to 10 nanosecond range. But this is a water, in the case of water molecules. And it's much different if you look at sort of tight binding made by fluorescent dye chelators. Mm-hmm. Does that make your answer to your questions?
I think it begins to answer yes. So it's a necessary aspect of connecting to the dye.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you would have to be very clever to think of a faster way, I suppose.
Thanks.
There's also a sodium pump. Mm-hmm. And if this pump transfers charge, why do we need two different kinds of pumps, a sodium pump and a calcium pump?
So is it again?
The sodium pump is responsible for the
sodium
generating
and
the action potential.
Sodium and potassium, but not calcium.
Yes. But what's the distinction? Why are the two separate pumping actions, one for sodium and one for calcium? It seems you could use one pump for both.
Well, for the specificity, you cannot, because it has to, for the sodium and calcium, it requires different environment, right? So the sodium is a monovalent ions, and the calcium is divalent ions, right? So in the case of divalent ions, the surrounding oxygen atoms, the sum of the partial, some of the oxygen atom has negative charges, and the negative charges should match the positive charges on the calcium, so it should match the charge itself. So the calcium binding site can sort of cannot have a high affinity to sodium, and it's the same thing applies to the sodium pump. Although the size is different, to make a high affinity to calcium, for example, it cannot be the sodium pump because it cannot make a high affinity sodium, right? So it's just a charge balance in this case.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.